Welcome to Warships Pod, and our guest is John Foreman, CBE, naval officer and former UK defence attaché in Moscow and Kyiv, who has also worked in Washington, D.C., NATO and in the EU. John bills himself on X as banned by Russia and decorated by Ukraine, and is an associate fellow of Chatham House. Also, he is, to quote Chatham House's online bio, an independent consultant specialising in Russia, Ukraine and international security. Welcome to the Warships Pod.
Thank you, Ian. Nice to be here.
Thank you. And it's good to have you here. A long time since we last met, which we'll come to soon. But before we get to your banning by Russia, being honoured by Ukraine and everything else, can we first of all rewind to 1991, the halcyon days of the Cold War, when it ended at sea between the Royal Navy and the Russian Navy. And I have to say, at that time, I believe, amid a fair bit of amity or pretend amity, which is when you and I first met. So that was aboard the anti-submarine warfare frigate HMS London, which undertook a historic voyage to Murmansk and Archangel, which actually happened in the aftermath of the so-called hardliners coup of August 1991. And that was all organised under something called Operation Dervish. And I just wondered if you could share with us some recollections of that time and also the London voyage, the HMS London voyage to Northern Russia.
Well, I was doing Russian as an interpreter, as studying Russian in Beaconsfield, Defence School of Languages at the time. And, you know, we'd been on the bus, off the bus. I'd been in Paris studying Russian just beforehand. You know, I came back, told the thing was off because of the coup, attempted putsch in Moscow. And then we were back on, flew up to Rosyth, joined the ship and sailed together with the Royal Marine Band, some journalists. And then we met up with an old liner, I think passenger ship, full of veterans. And you know, we sort of sailed up over the next few days. Lovely weather, I remember, getting into Murmansk in late August 1991, just in time for Dervish, which was obviously the 50th anniversary of the first Arctic convoys in 1941. So, and for me, I'd have been up there the year before in 1990 on a operation, surveillance mission on the HMS on Sheffield when I was the navigator, the old Nickleby operations. So to be in 1990 at the heart of the Russian or Soviet fleet spring exercises had been fantastic, you know, professionally. The next year, I'm sailing down the Kola Inlet into Murmansk, seeing the detritus of the Soviet Navy, the reality of it, not what they projected to us, given the consequences of the breakup of the Soviet Union and years of poor maintenance, and then getting alongside and being welcomed. So I think it was a time of, you know, new possibilities, new beginnings. So I got married just after that, actually, and a friend of mine gave me a matryoshka doll of Yeltsin and Gorbachev and etc. And there was a sort of tremendous optimism, both in Murmansk and Archangel, that we could set aside the 50 years of hostility of the Cold War and have a new start. Unfortunately, it didn't turn out like that.
And I remember at the time, because I was one of those journalists, that with the uncertainty created by the hardliners' attempted, you know, takeover in Moscow, it was on and off with the trip, but people at a diplomatic level, but people still carried on preparing. So do you remember much of the uncertainty going up around the North Air aboard the warship? Was that something that you at the time thought might turn back into the Cold War? I mean, how solid did we think the end of the Cold War was? And do you think the hardliners' attempted putsch was actually something that had stood a chance of success?
Well, I think with retrospect, you know, it was the most pathetic putsch in history. It only lasted 3 days. And, you know, we remember Yeltsin standing on a tank. And actually just near the British Embassy in Moscow, when I was serving there, as a flag flies over the underpass where three young Russian protesters were crushed by motor rifle troops heading towards, you know, the scene of the sort of major demonstration. And they were buried a few days later, you know, sort of the time we were heading up that way. A million people in Moscow turned out to their funeral. So I think, you know, I think at that time, I think we were incredibly optimistic that, you know, new Russia was going to be born out of the rubble of the Soviet Union, that Russians were committed to a, you know, more democratic path. We could set aside the confrontation, build a new relationship, which obviously was the policy in the 1990s. So, you know, I think waking up in that period. But I think what really struck me is when we got to Archangel was seeing the doors of the KGB locked and shackled, that No, there were 35,000 people, I think, out of that spring holiday seeing us come to anchor in the Dvina River, and then seeing, you know, they're telling us that the KGB has been shuttered, you know, the Communist Party headquarters has been shuttered. And you know, the people were just extremely positive and friendly. And I remember making a speech about how we'd been allies in World War II and we could be friends again, and that, you know, what happened didn't have to be, so be the conditions of our relationship going forward. And I think, you know, that perhaps, you know, obviously coming back to Moscow many years later to work, to see, to compare where we are now, you know, the darkness and tyranny of war in Ukraine and that period in 91 is a great shame. It's terrible, really, not just for international relations, but for the Russian people themselves.
And you were aboard HMS London, not as a member of the ship's company, but you were assigned as a translator, is that right?
Interpreter, yeah. So, you know, the Russian course then was 18 months long. I was, as I say, I got married just after we got back, actually. And so it was a period to reset after 5-6 years at sea, study Russian, get married. And we'd, there was, I think, 4 or 5 of us as the sort of, as the interpreters. And to, the opportunity to do it live, because, again, we did have great access to Russians from the Russian Navy in particular. So I remember on the way up, we're all rehearsing our Russian vocabulary, doing the exercises. So when we got to the Soviet Union, still was, and then, you know, Russia, Northern Russia, that could we actually interpret. So, you know, there were people being shown around the ship, translating boards for the ships open to visitors. There was opportunities to accompany various, you know, bands and delegations. I remember in Archangel, I was assigned to the Royal Marine Band, and they had this sort of young girls doing ballet. And I had this whole Royal Marine Band standing to one side waiting for the buses. And I went up to the organizer of the concert and said, hey, we've got the Royal Marine Band, the famous Royal Marine Band. Would you like them to play? And he said, we'd love to. So he gets up, basically goes like this, stop, 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 pushes his girls off, ushers the Royal Marines up. They do their fantastic thing. To huge applause, you know, from the Russians. So you see a Royal Marine Band marching up and down in Archangel. And then we all got on the bus and went off to the concerts, you know. And then we had, you know, veterans concerts and social veterans and veterans tours. So it's professional and social, really. But what an opportunity, rather than, you know, to study in class, doing these exercises for real, and actually turning out that my Russian wasn't too bad. Although it had changed. It's interesting, Russian spoken in Russia at the time was different from the one what we'd been studying. So it's an opportunity to be writing new words down in our notebooks and comparing notes to see how people actually speak.
And I remember on the river there, if I pronounce it correctly, River Dvina.
The Dvina, yeah.
Yeah, goes from the White Sea to Archangel, and HMS London and the RFA, I think it was Tidespring, that was accompanying the frigate, being there with the Russians in their yachts and their boats all around, and somebody shouting out, you know, you've liberated us, which seemed to be the feeling that they'd been freed from the yoke of, you know, Soviet oppression. But then when you moved on from that job, that mission, when did you next come into contact with the whole former Soviet Union sphere? When were you next plunged into that?
Yeah, I mean, just on that, I think, you know, on Archangel in particular, you know, that's how Britain, well, England opened its diplomatic relations with Russia in the 16th century. So it's always been a very Anglophilic city, and they're very proud of their history and links with England. And I'll come on to that maybe to my return. But so I did my Russian course. I then went to sea again as a principal warfare officer. Then I was on aircraft carriers. The next time I associated with the Russian Navy was when I was a flag officer sea training in 1998. Again, as an interpreter, but I was the staff warfare officer, communications, electronic warfare and intelligence. And we had a Russian ship come alongside, you know, to do this thing called Fruckus or Ruckus, the Russia, UK, US series of exercises. And that was eye-opening as well, to see, you know, a quote, modern Russian frigate come alongside in Plymouth and see where, you know, frankly, it was not particularly good. And the level of skills, professionalism was extremely low. So much so, we had to have riders on board the ship and interpreters to make sure you didn't crash into anything and execute a very modest set of drills at all. So there was that. And then I went back to sea, and then I went to the Ministry of Defense, and I went to America. So it wasn't really until 2006-07 when I was preparing to go to Ukraine as defense attaché. I was actually going back in and getting my Russian back up to speed and studying Ukrainian. And I arrived in Kiev in 2008. Now split from the Soviet Union, now independent democratic country, but with a very large Russian naval presence still down in Crimea at the time, and you know, a very difficult relationship between the two.
Yeah, and did you have to go down to the Crimea and Sevastopol to meet the Russians there and meet the Ukrainians there and do any kind of defence diplomacy that might ease the situation there, or was Britain's, you know, mission really to stay out of that sort of thing?
Well, it's funny, actually, because I was accredited to Ukraine, so I could have links with the Ukrainian Navy and fundamentally links with the Russian Navy were done through Moscow. So that's how it's played. Of course, they're in the same city and their sailors ashore at the same time. You know, the jetty, the Ukrainian jetty at the time was at one end and then the Russian jetty was the other end. So, I mean, first I need to make my number with the Ukrainian Navy and find out how they're doing and how we can help them in training and the Naval Academy, and as I orientate myself. I think one of the first trips I did was fly down there, meet the head of the Ukrainian Navy, jump on a Ukrainian Navy launch and ask to be taken around the harbour at Sevastopol to see the Ukrainian ships. And I also went up to the Ukrainian Navy further up in Crimea and also down in Balaclava. And also I took the opportunity for them to drive me around the Russian anchorage and take lots of pictures of aerials and, you know, ships. But to be honest, the Black Sea Fleet was not great condition in 2008. But because the Russian colleagues in Moscow couldn't come to Crimea, I also met the Russian Navy informally over a cup of coffee or two. So I was like John Foreman, who happens to live in Ukraine, and discussed how things were. And also, actually, I found out that they were planning to deploy to the Far East, which is very useful. They're quite open. And also, I met the people from the Sevastopol City Administration, which was like autonomous functioning inside Crimea. So again, they played both sides off against each other. So it was a very complex relationship because I was the British diplomat from Kiev going down there. There's the whole Crimean War. There's the whole siege of Sevastopol and lots of Anglophilic, locals. So they had, you know, museums, submarine bases, and battle reenactments, which I used to go down to. So it's just to see what the relationship's like, find out the situation, particularly between the Ukrainians and the Russians, and the chances of anything kicking off.
So when would you say that the relationship between Ukraine and Russia in that environment, let's say somewhere like Sevastopol or elsewhere, and also the West and the Russians changed? I mean, when did it all change? When did it all start turning from an uneasy kind of polite relationship into something else?
Well, when I was down in Sevastopol, you used to see the Russian flags everywhere. But the Moscow city was funding a lot of buildings down there. There was a Moscow University outreach. So it was definitely an ambition of the Russians, and Putin in particular, before I got there, from the early 2000s, to challenge Ukrainian ownership of Sevastopol in particular. And then, so that's the background. It was difficult in Sevastopol, not so much wider Crimea, but in particular because there's also a large number of retired Russian naval officers live there. So as a constituency, politically, you could vote and get various local deputies into the local administration. So that was difficult. But again, I think the war in Georgia in 2008, because Russia used ships from Sevastopol to attack Georgia, that was particularly difficult. And there was rumours of potential clash of Ukraine not allowing the Russians back into Sevastopol because they'd broken the basis of their treaty with the Ukrainians. And that blew over. And then Putin used to go down there and Medvedev would float around 2008, 2009. with the Black Wolves on their motorbikes, or Grey Wolves, whatever they are, just trying to stir up the situation. And then, of course, Yanukovych comes along, 2010, he signs a new 30-year waiver for Black Sea Fleet on there. But, you know, Putin's rhetoric was all about Sevastopol is the cradle of the Russian Navy, of Russia. You know, it's a sort of city of military glory sort of stuff. It's part of his sort of, should we say, slightly crazy ethnic nationalism, extreme nationalism. So that was all the subtext. And then, of course, that's really set the conditions for what happened in 2014 in the annexation by troops and sailors from the Russian presence in Crimea, first in Crimea and then the dirty war in Donbass and then Minsk and bloody full invasion. Again, you know, think at the time, you know, the focus was very much on Afghanistan and Iraq. So, you know, those were doing jobs then in Ukraine and Russia. It wasn't, yeah, the focus wasn't on you in terms of the mod. I mean, we thought Ukraine was important. We thought in Ukraine and Moscow that everybody taken their eye to, but they're unnecessarily taking their eye off the Russians and the Russian military. That Russia's not going away. It's only 4 hours from the UK. It still spends a lot of money on its defense. It has nuclear weapons. It has the largest army in Europe. But, you know, trying to get the mod to do more than one thing at once and say, well, it's all about Afghanistan, Iraq, mate, in the Gulf. Well, actually, it turned out that I was right and Burnett was wrong, that those are wars of choice. Now we're in a much more serious strategic confrontation with a country who's got the largest or second largest nuclear arsenal in the world and is waging a war in Ukraine and is committed to having 1.5 million people under arms. So I was a defense attaché. Well, I think we did succeed in articulating why Ukraine mattered to the UK government. I mean, got it moved up the list of priorities, got more money. And actually, I had a very large bilateral cooperation budget and program, the second biggest in the world after Jordan, bizarrely. That really, you know, enabled us to do stuff, both in terms of transforming the Ministry of Defence and also help the Ukrainian armed forces modernise. And that's why I got my medal, that's why I was decorated.
And what were the sort of things you were warning, apart from the obvious, like, you know, the Russians are possibly going to take over, you know, the Crimea or whatever. What were the things you were warning them about back in the UK that were signs to you that things would get a lot more serious and a lot more dark?
Well, I think, you know, I remember writing a diplomatic telegram actually about, you know, my ambassador asked me, how would Russia attack Crimea, or could they? And I said 2008, you know, because we knew that they had plans to do it. So the plans were there, were they going to act on it? And I pointed out the fact that, yes, they probably could, but let's face severe difficulty of such things as water and economic damage, you know, occupying Crimea, which turned out to be true. You know, if you look at where Crimea is now, where it was, there's quite a poor backward place. But, you know, we didn't see they had that time the intent to annex Crimea in 2014. I think that probably came as an opportunity to Putin in the wake of the Maidan 2013, 2014. He took his chance and it paid off because that convinced him in due course about his infallibility and how such a wise strategic thinker and decision maker is. But I think the rhetoric towards the relationship between Russia and Ukraine was deteriorating. The interference of Russia in Ukrainian domestic affairs, the attempts to try and get, you know, 2004 and 2010, Yanukovych to win, so he would be more, quote, Russia-friendly, and, you know, general hostility towards the West in the wake of 2007-2008, with Putin making mad speeches at Munich, slamming us for containing an historic, the British historic process of containing Russia and doing it down. So I think the trajectory was that way. And what we were saying is that Ukraine matters because if Ukraine's a democracy and it's anchored to the European grid and it's on a trajectory towards EU membership and NATO membership at some stage in the future, that's all good. It helps strengthen Ukraine. It helps security in Eastern Europe. And it also sends a message to Russians that, you know, Slavs can live in some form of democracy. But I think, you know, what you can't say is that, you know, we saw the signs in 2010-11 that there'd be annexation in 2014 and a full-scale war in 2022. So I think it's that trajectory over the years has been downwards steadily, basically since Putin became president 25 years ago.
Just to play devil's advocate a little bit, do you see any validity in the Russian claim that, you know, NATO pushed too far east. And I do remember there was a mine warfare group visited Sevastopol not long before the annexation.
Yeah, I remember it, yeah.
And also the EU thing. Do you think there's any validity in that? Do you think there were any errors made there in kind of pushing a little bit too soon, a bit too far?
Well, actually, no, I don't. You know, I think the whole NATO thing is used as a pretext by the Russians to justify aggression and a genocidal war in Ukraine. You know, the first round of enlargement, Poland, Hungary, and Czech Republic, went by without a squeak. So did the Baltics going in 2004, as did Finland and Sweden joining. You know, the whole idea that, you know, it's all about NATO encroachment, well, they've now got, Finland's got a 1,300-kilometre border with Russia, and they've taken risk with their forces in NATO, along in proximity to NATO, to send to Ukraine. So, as well as in Kaliningrad. So I think the whole thing is an absolute farce. It's used by Russian to blame us, actually. Russians to blame. Russia's the aggressor here, not the Ukrainians. We didn't do anything to attempt, you know, encourage Russia to attack Ukraine. That all comes out of the Kremlin. Unfortunately, it's used by Russia-friendly voices and Russian useful idiots in the West to blame themselves and blame ourselves. And I think that's incorrect. So you have to be careful. I think what the war in Ukraine is always about, it's been about subjugation of Ukraine and denying Ukrainians their nationality. So both sovereignty and nationality, it's not about NATO. And actually, I think, you know, Russia and NATO signed a treaty or an agreement in 1996 or 97, the Foundation Act, which set the conditions of our relationship and which we stuck to. So it's Russia who broke that treaty. It's Russia who broke the UN Charter. It's Russia who broke the OSCE. It's Russia who broke the bilateral treaty with Ukraine, not us.
And when you say Russia took risk with Kaliningrad, you mean they have used naval infantry brigades or whatever, missile forces or air forces from exclave in Kaliningrad, which used to be East Prussia and was taken over at the end of the Second World War. And also they've sent forces from Murmansk, haven't they, the Murmansk area, down to fight in Ukraine. So are you saying that if they really feared NATO, then they wouldn't have taken troops away and other units to go and fight in Ukraine?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the 8th Corps in Kaliningrad. And they've taken lots of troops from there. They've taken air defences from Kaliningrad. They've taken ships because they sent them around to the Black Sea, which are now bottled up, been sunk because they can't get them out. They've taken the naval infantry in Murmansk has been destroyed, as has, I think, the Arctic Specialist Army Brigade up there has been destroyed. The forces which are on paper down the eastern border of Finland, you know, the Western Front, that bit between Murmansk and St. Petersburg, are Potemkin units, very, very thin, just scattered very thinly. I mean, when you see Arctic specialist units being used to fight in Ukraine, you realise how desperate the Russians got in sort of 22, 23, to stem their breach and to bail themselves, try and bail themselves out. So, the reason Russia keeps these exclaves like Kaliningrad and, you know, Crimea, this is to be able to project security forward into Europe. And extend that Iskanders, you know, missiles, long-range missiles, to deter us and to hold our infrastructure at risk. But they've actually taken that away. They've denuded their defences against NATO to fight their mad war in Ukraine. So I think, again, it's a sign that whatever they say in public about NATO is not backed up on the ground.
And so to fast forward a bit and go into some of the aspects of the Ukraine war in a little bit more detail, and from your particular and very, I'm sure, very fascinating perspective, you became the defence attaché in Moscow in 2019,
yeah, October.
And you were there when the whole thing kicked off with the...
Before, during and after.
Tell us about what that was like. I mean, that must have been really... Did you think that you were being plunged into the hot seat, as it were, or into the cauldron when they sent you there in 2019?
The boiling frog, yeah. I mean, I think actually it was in the wake of the Skripal expulsions 2018. You know, so we'd had, again, it was about the deterioration of relationships and the turns into darkness and tyranny. We'd had Skripal poisonings 2018, you know, that come on top of annexation of Crimea and Donbass. But I think, you know, I was get there in 2019. with my eyes wide open, what the situation is going to be. I thought it was going to be extremely difficult. I remember writing to the ministers in early 2020, because there were some people in London saying it's time to turn the page after Skripal's, you know, why can't we get back to normal steaming to do business and cooperation on climate change and the economy and education and science, technology and Arctic research, whatever. And I said that's probably false, because I thought the amount of propaganda here, the hostility towards us here, there is no light at the end of the tunnel. You know, we had to prepare ourselves to protect ourselves away from the keeping open engagement side of our relationship to the protecting and constraining, containing Russia, argument. But then we had Navalny poisoned. Navalny came back arrested. And we had HMS Defender. We had the first build up to the military build up around Crimea in 2021. And then the final push towards, invasion. So there's a Russian website used to say, every day in Russia is worse than the day before, worse than yesterday. So that's how I took it, that, we were heading downwards inexorably. As the propaganda got worse, the hostility towards us, as Russia made threats towards Ukraine, and then finally the invasion in February 22, and then we had what I had 7 months after that to work out the consequences.
Yeah, and when you mentioned HMS Defender there as being a warships magazine, just to ask you a little bit about that, that was when the Type 45 destroyer HMS Defender peeled away from escorting the Carrier Strike Group 2021 deployment.
That's right.
Which ended up in Japan, and she was the primary, or one of two actual destroyers deployed. The other one was HMS Diamond as air defense vessels. And she went up to visit
Odessa,
that's right. I nearly said Sevastopol, but that wasn't possible anymore. And I remember seeing the images put out, I think, by the Royal Navy, the UK MOD, of Ukrainian Marines training with Royal Marines aboard Defender. So just to explain to listeners, that ship visits with the tensions climbing and those joint exercises take place. And then when she left Odessa, she went over in international waters towards Crimea. So what was it like from your end to handle that incident where the Russians sent out vessels to basically allegedly fire weapons near HMS Defender, and also I believe aircraft as well, to do things? So what was that like?
Now, first, just quickly on the background, we've been thinking about this for ages, the merits, the strengths and weaknesses, advantages, opportunities, risks, all that.
Of sending Defender to Odessa.
I mean, my view, sending Defender into the Black Sea at all, and secondly, to do this transit. So my strategic view was that the priority was the CSG-21 deployment to the Far East, and not to screw up because of the potential of risk, a Type 45. However, we've discussed it and decided at very high levels that we're going to do this, to transit through an international traffic separation scheme, through occupied Crimean territorial waters, en route from Odessa to Batumi, which, is perfectly legal. So I knew it was coming up. They didn't, although I think the Russians were probably dead, because we'd done something similar with HMS Dragon at the end of 2020. Which the Russians had been completely caught in the hop by. So they were absolutely determined not to be caught in the hop, although they were caught in the hop because they're hopeless, but they were determined not to be. So anyway, the ship sails, turns left, points towards Batumi, goes through traffic separation scheme in accordance with the international law of the sea, causes huge ructions of, aircraft and FSB border guard trying to chase it off. And the border guard being left in the image I had is the border guard corvettes being left in the wake as this 6,000-7,000 ton destroyer, modern destroyer, just charges off the background into the distance. And then we had the lies that they dropped bombs and fired thwarting shots, which is a total lie from the aircraft. So anyway, I'm in Moscow. I'm attending the Moscow Security Conference, knowing this is going to go down, listening to all these hoods from the regime, Putin and Bortnikov and Patrushev and Shoigu and all that. And my phone suddenly starts pinging, and all the other attachés look at me, So, you know, your boy's up to, oh, you know, what can I do, you know? And then I got summoned that afternoon to the Russian MOD, and they were absolutely furious. You know, it's all been pre-staged, you know, if it happens. You know, call the defense attaché, hand me a docket. And, you know, we'd war-gamed it, you know, back in the embassy. How am I going to approach this? So if you look at the video, which is on YouTube, I sort of stroll in. I didn't want to be one of those sort of over-eager Air Force officers who scuttles in with a massive file under his arm, looked like he's been summoned to the headmaster's office. I wanted just to stroll in languidly and say, you know, I've got a tennis match at 4:30 this afternoon. Do you mind? You know, that sort of stuff. To play it down and to keep the calm down and, you know, not to give away any emotion. And then just my three key points were, the ship's quite you know, justified to sail through a transfer separation scheme. We don't recognise how you characterise incident. And in any case, we don't recognise your Russian jurisdiction over Ukraine territorial waters. Please go off politely. And that was it. It was all televised, you know, and out we went. And I think it probably didn't change the UK-Russia relationship, but it's reassured to the Russians that we were their implacable foe. But they've had the same view of us for like 400 years. So being the recipient of all that, it was a new and not necessarily pleasurable experience. But actually, in the room, I always found that, you know, with the Russian Ministry of Defence, we could be professional without shouting at each other. We'd had a previous example when we had ships up in the Barents as part of a UK-US task force, and it was much less professional. They started shouting about the Cuba Missile Crisis. I said, it's international waters. We're quite within our rights to go there. We stayed 50 miles off the coast. We conducted, you know, local training exercises. There was no danger. And then, again, just to try and calm things down. So I think that the Royal Navy should be assertive towards the Russian Federation Navy. We shouldn't self-censor us and self-deter ourselves. We should get back to the measured professional interactions that we had during the Cold War, including the Barents and the Baltic and the Black Sea.
Yeah, and it's a thin line to walk, isn't it? I mean, you said you were up in the Barents in...
Yeah, I went back again in 1994. So I did 90, I forgot, in 1990, I did the Nickleby intelligence gathering. 91, I did Dervish. And then did 94, again, another Nickleby. But it was interesting when I got back to Moscow that we hadn't really done one up there for 20 years. So why have we not been, well, 30 years almost, why have we not been in the Barents?
Yeah, well, exactly, yeah.
And I said this to the First Sea Lord, you know, it's international waters, that's where the Russian Navy is, on surface ships, you know, not talk about anything else, but why have our maritime patrol aircraft not up there regularly? So we need to understand what the Russians are up to, what the capabilities are, and that requires getting up into the Barents and not sort of skulking around the South Coast exercise areas.
Yeah, just to diverge a little bit, you mentioned that you were at that conference in Moscow when the news of the Type 45 being harassed broke. And you referred to them as hoods. And so I just wondered, can you give us an insight into what it was like to be living in Moscow, to be a defense attaché in Moscow? Because I have spoken to, in the past, to one of your predecessors as a naval attaché, Jonathan Holloway, and he told me some interesting stories about how he was monitored. So, I mean, did you get close monitoring? Did you have any strange incidents where they showed you that they could spy on you whatever they wanted?
Well, I mean, at first it was very difficult, you know, when I got there. In the wake of Skripal, you know, military cooperation had been finished off or closed, you know, finished, terminated. And I wasn't worried about that. I know some people said we should go back to cooperating. And I said, no, you know, we should not be cooperating with the Russians because the Russian GRU murdered Dawn Sturgis in Salisbury. Actually, the surveillance wasn't, initially, it was quite light, I thought. And they backed off a bit. And my wife, you know, she came out after Christmas, 2020, and we were walking through this famous cemetery, and it was in snow, and it was clear blue sky, it's all lovely. And I'm walking past Khrushchev's grave there, down towards Yeltsin's grave. And this guy taking these pictures. I thought, well, that's a great picture to take, you know, these two couples walking through the snowy scenes with the blue sky. And I realized he wasn't taking a picture of the cemetery, he was taking a picture of me. And that was really the first time, you know, that we had constant surveillance for 2.5 years, 3 years, night and day, physical and electronic at all times. I think you just have to accept that. You know, they sometimes start, you know, with a couple people, then two to four people, six people, cameraman, video cameraman. And you just have to accept that. In cars, you get to recognize the cars. They come into the restaurants, they sit next to you. They have, you know, recognizable tactics they use against you. But if you start to see the same people doing the same thing, you still get in the pattern of life. And then, I mean, I found I could lose them if I wanted to. I'm not. But if you just assume they're going to be there, then that's the best way to do it. But I've also meant that, you know, so when we came up to was the invasion, and knowing what I knew from other sources, there's no way really to talk about this. I mean, apart from a couple of places, you can't talk about anything to your wife or anybody at any time outside. So I sort of felt this sort of massive pressure before the invasion. You know, my emotional state was all over the place, really, because I'd lived in Ukraine. My friends were in bond by the people I'd been working with. And then afterwards, I think the surveillance only went up. And I think we had a couple of moments of harassment. We were leaving a Russian church, famous one, up on the Golden Ring, which is on the Volga, because we still wanted to travel, get outside of Moscow, see people, meet people. And as we were walking out, this chap in Russia asked me for a cigarette. So, sorry, mate, don't smoke. He said, oh, you're English, yeah. He said, in Russian, why are you supplying weapons to Ukrainians to kill our boys? You know, you're blah, 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 you know. So I said to my wife, you know, would you go back, darling, go back to the car, please? And she said, I don't want to go back to the car. I said, darling, please go back to the car, lock yourself in. And then we had this sort of two guys shouting at me. And the third one had his mobile phone like this, filming. Obviously, want to get a reaction. That brilliant naval officer ends up having scrap with Russian, patriotic Russians. So I just played the sort of, you know, Hugh Grant, how lovely, or Prince Charles, you know, King Charles, how lovely to see you. Have you come far? Lovely weather we're having. But I love you, beautiful day. And then they gave me 5 minutes and they've buggered off. But I think that wasn't just against me. There was,
yeah,
against various members of the embassy. But I think since I've left, it's got worse again. And there'd be more expulsion. So it's a constant process of reducing numbers, the work staying high, constant pressure from the Russians. And that's what they want to achieve. They want to achieve us to feel unable, yeah, to leave the embassy and under pressure the whole time.
So that bit on the Golden Circle, that was after the war, the major...
After the invasion, yeah, that was in mid-spring, late spring, 2022.
Right. Okay, so, yeah.
And okay, I think the surveillance went up, obviously, because obviously the British Defence Attaché driving around Russia. I think I suspect my car may have been sabotaged. All my fuel pissed out, right, my diesel tank, which is unusual on a Land Rover because they're pretty robust. And that happened around that period. So they may have, you know, had a whack at it with a hammer. But, you know, that's occupational hazard, I think, working.
Right, we're not, yeah.
And colleagues of mine had, you know, flat entries, people being threatened. My American colleague was caught, you know, flicking the bird at some patriotic thing, and he was expelled. So, you know, it just got very, very difficult. And then, you know, meeting Russians. I still wanted to go and try and meet Russians if I could. And actually, you know, the relationship I had with, you know, meeting normal Russians was fine, as long as I sort of set out the rules of the conversation beforehand that, you know, I'm not here as a British Defence Attaché, please tell me about your tanks sort of thing. There's other ways of having the conversation.
Yeah, I mean, as Defence Attaché, I believe you, in the run-in to the invasion, I'd just be interested in hearing a little bit about the run-in. You organised a major summit between, I think, the Russian military and Ministry of Defence officials. Did that? It might have been the one that included Liz Truss as well. So how did that come about? And It struck me at the time, and I think I've read somewhere, that they basically just told a load of old porkies just to show off how mighty they were. And then what did you think when the run in,
yes.
You know, what was it like in the immediate sort of run in to the invasion, the major invasion?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because we'd had a very high point, it was a naval podcast talking about going back to Archangel in the August, September 2021. So that's 30 years after you and I were up there. I'm back there as a defense attaché, having good commemoration of the Arctic convoy.
When you were in defense attaché in
laying wreaths,
you were back there.
Yeah.
All right, okay.
2021.
Oh, I see.
And then, you know, we have the run up to the war. So the run up to the war really kicked off for us in about October 21. So we'd had this high point. I met the Northern Fleet commander, who's now the commander of the Navy. They'd laid on a concert for us. They'd had a whole naval parade. There were march pasts, very friendly, very chummy. They played, we get this concert, and the bandmaster, this played a concert of Russian patriotic music, and they then fire up the Hearts of Oak, and he turns around and salutes me, and I say, I'm saluting back, you know, it's all great. Lots of applause and, you know, toasts and future cooperation. Also things on Arctic science and historical links between the Western Forces Museum and the Archangel Maritime Museum. Yeah, so it was all great. And a few weeks later, we get wind that the Russians are up to something bad in, you know, in Ukraine. And then from then on, it got worse and worse and worse. They start deploying forces. So in February 2022, we had the Foreign Secretary Liz Truss on a flying visit. And the day after, we had Ben Wallace and Tony Radakin come and meet the Minister of Defense, Russian MOD, General Gerasimov, at 2 weeks' notice. So, as you imagine, it's like the biggest visit to defense visit, UK defense visit to Moscow since 1944, the Churchill Allenbrook. So, I realized I was like, the stakes are pretty big here. You know, don't fuck screw it up, John. Yeah. And, yeah, so we had the delegation arrive, they laid wreaths at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, which I wanted to do, and the Russians really pushed the boat out here, full ceremonial. Ben Wallace did a great job. We had, you know, the Prime Minister's Foreign Policy Advisor, Chief of Defence Staff, the head of the British Army's Land Forces, you know, others, Ambassador, me, paying our respects. Then we went off to the MOD and met Shoigu, who's Defence Minister at the time, Gerasimov. And the plenary was all starchy, you know, the major meetings are all starchy. Shoigu listed his complaints, Ben Wallace rebutted them, and then we broke into individual meetings. So I was with Tony Radakin and Gerasimov, and Ben Wallace went to see Shoigu. And I think what was interesting was, you know, the emotion I thought Shoigu was displaying about Ukraine, you know, how the Ukrainian Nazis, Donbass, that sort of rhetoric. And then Gerasimov boasting how his forces have reached parity with the Americans, which I thought was nonsense. I worked in the Pentagon, yeah. So it's a bit of a myth they're telling themselves. You know, we're not going to invade. However, if the Ukrainians keep on doing this, therefore we'll have to do something. So came back to the conclusions. One, they're telling the truth, they're not going to invade, and they want to have a better relationship with us, which we set out. Or two, they're Champions League liars, and, you know, this is just a string that's along. And anyway, it didn't work because Ben Wallace ordered even more accelerations of weapons into Ukraine. So I don't think we pulled any wool over our eyes. But again, I think it was useful to set out not just the situation in Ukraine, but if we were interested about wider European security as well, and in particular the UK Russian relationship in light of all this. So, yeah, busy times. And then 2 weeks later, we woke up to Putin, his twisted face on TV announcing his invasion.
Yeah, I mean, did you ever meet Putin? Did you meet him?
No. In a normal country, the defense attaché accompanies the ambassador to his or her accreditation meeting. So when you see the king meets ambassadors, he has a private audience. Defense attaché is normally floating around the background looking spectacular, had a great uniform. But Yes, Putin doesn't do that. What he does is he lines them all up in a line, all the ambassadors are lined, and does some trite speech. Doesn't really engage because that's how arrogant he is. And then leaves. So when my ambassador at the time was accredited, they had the P5 and the P4, you know, the UK, US, China and France were all lined up like naughty school children before Putin. And his speech on his website. And yeah, they have people from, I don't know, Burkina Faso and, you know, Mozambique in the same meeting. So it's all of absolutely no value whatsoever. It's all about Putin showing how big man he is and how he lords it over these ambassadors, which of course doesn't really help having productive diplomatic relations. So no, I didn't meet him. If I had, I'm not sure what I said, to be honest, especially after the invasion.
Yeah. So you had the big meeting, the big powwow, and then 2 weeks later, the major invasion goes ahead. So as you said earlier, you were sitting there watching presumably the news feed of whatever was being allowed to be broadcast, seeing people who were your friends being bombarded, and from your time in Ukraine, and there you are in the midst of the Russian nation, which is actually doing the attacking. So I mean, yeah, that must have been incredibly personal for you and quite,
yeah, exactly,
emotional to see that. I mean, how did you handle it?
Yeah, I mean, I'd sent my wife back actually to the UK a couple of weeks beforehand because I was a bit worried of, you know, the experience we'd had, people have had in the past about being harassed, you know, that they might all kick off, you know, but easy is one thing I didn't have to think about if my wife's back in the UK. Anyway, so she's back in the UK, but this is all going on. It was the first day, you're all sort of wrapped up in the work, you know, the embassy's in crisis, you're issuing updates to inform the whole government system, to make better decisions and policy. You know, we see the whole thing unravel, all the sort of plans we put in place, you know, Prime Minister's statements, Defence Secretary statements in the House, sanctions rolling out, all that. But it wasn't, you know, then the evening, because we're like 2 or 3 hours ahead, you know, by the time Boris is speaking, the Parliament, you know, we're already eating fast food and drinking beer in the bar. And I thought, you know, made a great statement, but it was later after that, you know, it sort of sank in when you see the news feeds. Because I haven't really watched the news, to watch the news of Kiev, where I live 3 years, you know, got friends being bombarded. And, you know, Ukraine singing the national anthem all set me off. So it set me off, and I found it extremely emotional. You know, now my equilibrium was, I'd had probably cut too many whiskies that by the stage, so it didn't help. And the next day's situation, you know, normal service was resumed, but I'm still absolutely furious about it because it's an absolute wicked act of naked aggression against another country. And there's no sugarcoating that. And it can't be turning the page from what Putin's done. And, you know, when you see the faces of those killed in Ukraine, the children, you know, men, women, and children, it brings home the consequences of war, you know, to our front rooms. And I think that Russia has sent itself back. You know, it's descending to the darkness and tyranny even more quickly than it was beforehand. So, yeah, I do find it emotional. Even now, I have to sort of check myself when I'm lecturing because I know that, you know, my emotions are close to my surface. You know, I took some R&R after about 2 months, went to see a friend of mine in Dubai, and I remember having a beer on the departure lounge and starting to cry. So it was my wife, you know, having to look after me and get me off and basically sit me by a pool for a week to decharge, because, you know, we'd been at it by 9 months by this stage and we were sort of completely sort of ran out.
So when were you actually banned, and why were you banned? I mean, obviously there's the way the UK is and other nations have got behind Ukrainians and that, yeah, you know, has gone, I suppose, in Russia's view, very close to, you know, being a direct confrontation. So that's been, must have been very difficult to manage things during any of that. But how did you get banned? What was it particularly that got you banned?
Yeah, so I think, you know, I said something else. I think, you know, it's either a lifetime achievement award for being beastly to the Russians, or it's because I wrote in The Economist that Gerasimov is a war criminal, and he should be compared to Yodel and Mladic, because the war crimes in Crimea, in Ukraine, are a direct consequence of the sort of brutality and the moral vacuum of leadership exerted by Gerasimov. So you know, the whole machine rots.
So Gerasimov is head. Just for listeners, though, he's the head of the Russian armed forces. Yeah,
he's chief of general staff. Yeah, he's head, and he's been there for like 13 years now. So he, I said, was personally responsible for the war crimes in Ukraine. I wrote that as the crimes became after crimes became clear, and Bucha and areas were liberated, how the Russians were treated, what they've been doing against Ukraine's children. The complicity of the Russian armed forces in the abduction of children, their support to the FSB, you know, death squads running around Ukraine. So that's what got me banned. So I was rung up by the FCO saying, John, I'm not sure how to tell you this, but you know, you may have to think about it. You'll be banned. I said, well, that's great. You know, I don't care, to be honest. It's a select list.
But you were still in Russia then, were you? Sorry to interrupt.
No. It's when I got back.
Right.
I wasn't expelled.
You didn't get the ultimate.
I came close, I think, a couple of times because of where we were in the UK-Russian relations, but I managed to see off most of my time. My successor was expelled last year, which I thought was a retrograde step. You've managed to have attachés in Moscow since 1946, and we should be, I think, more strategically about the advantage of having military people in Moscow trying to find out what the Russians are up to.
Yeah, I mean, you think what happened in the Cold War, the events, you know, Cuban Missile Crisis, the Hungarian invasion, the Czech uprising, Korea, Vietnam. Yeah.
Korea, Vietnam, Afghanistan. We managed to keep diplomatic relations going on as well as military relations despite all that. And I think, you know, again, Russia's not going away. It represents a real threat at sea. In peacetime and a war, it's got the largest nuclear arsenal in Europe. It's got the biggest army in Europe. Not having military people, not just a defense attaché with the Army, Navy, Air Force in Moscow, we're talking to people and trying to provide advice and challenge to London is important. I think that's the same as it was. You know, we've only really had no attaché since the Crimean War between 1918 and 1941, and then. From 2024 onwards. So that shows, I think, the poverty of strategic thinking, decision-making at the heart of government, and the willingness to be seen to be tough on the Russians sometimes gets in the way of sort of sober assessment of our national interest and the importance of having load-bearing channels to produce risk, or manage risk, sorry.
So to sum up, it's been a really interesting chat. Wish we had more time, but we might get you back some stage. To sum up, that was interesting what you said there, because even though you feel very emotional and quite rightly about the war and what it's done to people you know, and you've seen up close the gangster state with nukes, which is Russia, you know, and its leadership, the hoods, you still think that there's no way around this at all but to remain engaged with them at a diplomatic level whilst also trying to cope with what happens with the course of the war. I mean, is that something you would always hold to, something that's in your very being, that you think that you must always keep talking no matter how horrific the enemy are?
Yeah, I don't think we should be talking for talking's sake. I think there's been a kind of post-Cold War thing that, you know, cooperation, quote-unquote, and dialogue is, you know, and it means to, it's an end in itself. I think it's a mean to an end. We want to have strategic stability between two nuclear powers in Europe, and also our role towards NATO is extending our nuclear weapon umbrella to our NATO allies. So that's important. But I think we've had extremely bouncy relations for centuries because we don't share core interests. So we can have sort of pragmatic relations, other times no relations. But as I said, Russia's not going away. I think, you know, sort of, as a British diplomat advised Ernest Bevin in 1946, you know, Russia is a permanent gale. It's not a short squall. So if we're going to navigate that gale, we're going to have times when the weather's against us and times when the weather's with us. But ultimately, that gale, sometimes we sort of pour oil on troubled waters. there's sometimes there may be brief periods where our interests align, but actually, you know, a country which is so important for, I think, in European security, for European security, requires our engagement, diplomatic, and at the highest levels, in people speaking to the Russians clearly, forcefully, and with logic.
Yeah, that does seem like a good way of dealing with them. And it's interesting that in 1991, the mission by a warship, HMS London, to Murmansk and Arkhangelsk was seen as so important, despite the hardliners' coup, the failed coup, and I guess that navies are an important way of finding something with a kind of common cause, like, you know, World War II convoys to Russia, where you can maybe build one or two bridges. And people ought not to forget that military forces, and in particular the Royal Navy, can be used as ambassadors too, can't they?
I agree. I mean, I think, you know, of all the services, the Royal Navy's had the deepest relations with, you know, Russian services, the Russian Federation Navy, just as Nelson had relations with Ushakov in the Mediterranean in the late 18th century, just as we had relations during the Second World War, you know, not just over the convoys, but over, our support to Russia in the early stages of the invasion in 1941, including air power, so Hurricanes, and the amount of stuff we provided to Russia to help stop the Germans at the gates of Moscow in December 1941. So I think, you know, the Navy has played a central role. I'm not one of those who says, you know, that we should go back to where we were. But I think I got a new treaty signed in 2021 to regulate interactions with our ships at sea. So irrespective of, you know, the political situation, it's in our interest to keep our ships and our sailors and our ships and our airmen and women safe in the air when we're operating close to the Russians, even if the days, halcyon days of amity and cooperation are long gone, and I don't think we'll return.
Yeah, and that's a good positive to end on, I think. So thanks very much, John, for coming on the podcast. It's been a great chat.
Thank you, Ian. Much appreciated.
Connect with us via social media on X and Facebook, and in both cases that's at WarshipsIFR. And you can also find us on YouTube at WarshipsIFR TV. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on your podcast app. Keep your eye on the horizon for our next episode.